Summer, the best time of the year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there was another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. At IKEA, everyone can have lounge chair access. No reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, they have all of the essentials that you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
Who doesn't love shopping at Target? Did you know the all-new Target Circle is the free and easy way to get the most deals at Target? And when you pay with your Target Circle card, you can save an extra 5% your way every day. But wait, there's more. Now you've got a new way to save with Target Circle 360. With unlimited same-day delivery, Target Circle 360 is the fastest way to get your order to your door or someone else's. Right now, sign up for Target Circle 360 for just $49 for your first year of membership. That's $50 off the regular price. Visit target.com/circle or the Target app for more details. Same-day delivery is subject to terms, applies to orders over $35. For a 5% discount, restrictions apply. See program rules in store or at target.com/circle card.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am all in.
More, more, more. I wanna kiss you more. More, more, more. I wanna kiss you more.
I am all in with Scott Patterson, an iHeartRadio podcast.
Hey everybody, Scott Patterson, I am all in podcast, one-on-one interview, 111 Productions, iHeartRadio, iHeartMedia, iHeartPodcast. We have the extreme privilege of talking to one of the biggest legends in the history of the entertainment business, Mr. Paul Anka. And let me tell you something a little bit about this guy and what he has accomplished so far in his life. He is a legendary singer and songwriter who's best known for his signature hit songs, Diana, Lonely Boy, Put Your Head on My Shoulder. As a songwriter, Paul wrote the theme song for The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, Tom Jones's hit, She's a Lady, Frank Sinatra's signature song, My Way. And if that isn't enough, with over 900 songs to his credit, Paul's songs have also been recorded by, ready for this, Elvis Presley, Barbara Streisand, Linda Ronstadt, the Sex Pistols, Nina Simone, Gypsy Kings, and Robbie Williams, to name a few. I am a big fan of all of those people, especially Robbie Williams. Now Paul has ventured into podcasting with his best friend Skip Bronson in their show Our Way with Paul Anka and Skip Bronson. The series will give listeners a backstage pass to the lives of icons across film, music, television, sports, and technology in a whole new way. Listeners will hear from guests across industry, including Jason Bateman, Mark Burnett, Michael Bublé, Bill Burr, Billy Bush, Gail King, and even the president of France, Emmanuel Macron. So, Paul, let's first start off. We're going to talk a little bit about Gilmore Girls, and we're going to get into your career as a songwriter, and then we're going to talk about your podcast. Let's start off with the Gilmore stuff. When did you first hear about Lorelai's dog being named after you?
Well, I think it was right from the inception, you know, a heartbeat later when I got out there, obviously, and you know, I became a huge fan of the show. Obviously, it was a great show, well written, et cetera, et cetera. But from the inception, you know, probably what after the first couple of weeks, everybody came around and I heard about it. And I thought it was cool because it was so international. I've been an international creature, but I was ultimately hearing from everybody all over the world.
So you were aware of the show before you found out about it?
Friends were watching it. I think my kids were watching it.
Right.
You know, big show. I mean, we're not talking about something obscure. This show was like, everybody loved it. So I was very much aware of the show. Yeah.
Right. And then you made a cameo in the cold open of season 6, episode 18. Tell us how that came about, that black and white.
Well, dream I sequence. Got the call and I said, yeah, let's do it. I think we did a couple. When I first got the call, I was very happy to do it. You know, I thought, yeah, natural for me. And they were great to work with. They were just a fun group of people and very bright, knew what they were doing. And that was very comforting to me.
Right. Do fans approach you about your appearances on Gilmore Girls?
I still do. Fans, I got friends, I got people at dinner parties. I mean, it always comes up. And, you know, I hate the phrase, it is what it is, but it is what it is. And it was great to be a part of it. You know, it was something that I wore like a badge. I loved
it. Right. Let's talk a little bit about your music career. Because this is reading your bio and reading about you and listening to all the old songs. It's just absolutely fascinating. I'm a songwriter myself, so I'm really eager to hear about your background. I mean, you sold songs. You were writing songs. You were a musical prodigy growing up.
Yeah.
And you sold songs. You went to New York and sold a song when you were, what, 15, 16 years old?
I was born in Ottawa, Canada. And my dad wanted me to, you know, be a lawyer like my uncle or a journalist because I'd won awards for my short stories in school. So I had kind of a writing way about me. I was typing 70 words a minute. I was in a class with 40 girls, me and my friend. Right. And I always got drawn to music. You know, back then it was pretty much the R&B, rhythm and blues, and some country, and it pops the vibe. It just kind of integrated itself, but it was primarily, you know, it was the black movement in music, like it's been for many decades, that really kind of was inspiring. And I fell out of shorthand class. I hated it, and the teacher wasn't too thrilled with me. And you know, when you're a teenager, it's you think you know everything, but.
Right.
I just said, okay, put me in music class. So I started taking drums, I started taking trumpet. And then I wound up with Mrs. Reese, who was a piano teacher. And she started in on me. And then my dad got me a little old piano that they stuck in a basement. You know, I was writing in this basement. It was not a decked out basement. You know, we had a modest background. Mm-hmm. So I started in Ottawa, and I just started messing around on the piano, you know, and it wasn't until I got kind of inspired with this crush that I had on this girl that was, I think, 3 years older than me, which, you know, back then that was a big deal, along with everything else, how tall you were, how this you were, how what you were. So I just sat down, and, you know, I wrote like a kid, I'm so young, you're so old. I don't think I could get away with that today with the media. But, you know, I wrote it, and it started with that. And ultimately, like any process, I said, okay, now what's the next step? And I started reading at all these record labels I had that if you had got to Nashville, LA, or New York, maybe Chicago, somebody would hear you. So, you know, with a couple of, you know, songs in my pocket, some money I'd saved up on an Easter vacation, and I got to New York, walked into an office. Some friends of mine set up an appointment for me. And Don Costa, I mean, I attribute, you know, a lot of my success to a team effort. You know, you never want to be the smartest guy in the room. And Don Costa was the guy. He's the one that saw this kid banging away at the piano. And from May when I recorded to August when I wound up at American Bandstand and Ed Sullivan, that's when it all took off.
How old were you on Ed Sullivan?
15 or 16.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So you were singing and you were writing the songs you were singing, and they were big number one hits or charting and way up in the charts, and you were a teen idol and super famous at 15, 16.
Well, you know,
years
it was
old.
Kind of freaky. You know, it wasn't really the day and age of young idols or whatever the hell they wanted to call them.
Right.
That all kind of morphed itself with the Philadelphia guys, but it's all timing, you know. I just had the passion and the drive and nothing else. and then you hone your talent, whatever that is. But there was no television in the sense of the programs you see today.
Right.
No, you know, none of these talent contests. And it just happened so quickly because the mere content of what we did and the structure that was around this, you were a hit in 1 week with radio. Mm. You did Sullivan, American Bandstand. You went on radio, and within a week, the whole country knew who you were. So there I was. I was in the middle of that with people that were twice my age until the others started floating in, and then I started working with, you know, Beverly Brothers and Frankie Lyman, Frankie Avalon, all these young artists who had with the young movement. We were traveling together on these buses, each doing two songs through, you know, all kinds of weather, breakdown with buses that weren't luxurious. And we're all thrown together like little pioneers. And that's where it all happened, you know. And you looked up to the Rat Pack in Las Vegas. That's all there was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Beatles, which is another story, which I think I had a hand in getting them over here because I met them in Europe. But that was the industry until the Beatles, until Hendrix changed it in terms of picking up a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I just continued honing my craft, knowing I was still a kid, but writing about only what I knew. Puppy Love, right. Shoulder, Lonely Boy, all that kind of stuff.
Right, right, right.
And loving it. Just saying, wow, I'm making $200 a week. You know, I had a paper route. I was a caddy. I worked in restaurants. I was earning $3 a week. And, you know, that's when you learn to be focused, you know, because you learn at some point in there that you may not last, you know, and a lot of the guys I grew up with didn't. So until you make each of those evolutions, you keep doing what you're doing, getting better, whether it's Tonight Show theme, Longest Day. You know, my big reach out was for Buddy Holly, who was my friend.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote It Doesn't Matter Anymore for him, it was the last song he unfortunately recorded because he died on that plane crash on the tour.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, you mentioned two things, how it happened so quickly for you at 15, and then your relationship with the Beatles and bringing them over to the United States. Tell us, you get to New York, you have a song, who hears it? What happens after they hear it? How did they hear it?
Yeah.
Who signed you? How did you get on Ed Sullivan? Did an agent come in? Did a record company sign you right away? And then it was just off to the moon for you?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, I had saved up some money. It was Easter vacation. I went down to New York. I'd been there prior because I won a contest collecting soup wrappers for Campbell's Soup. So I got a feel for New York. Don Costa, as I mentioned, was with this new company, ABC Paramount. I had this appointment. I went up, jeans, t-shirt, you know, walked in, scared to death, sat down and played, I think, Diana, Don't Gamble with Love, and Tell Me That You Love Me.
In his office, right there, yeah. In his office, right there in his office, in New York. Okay.
Oh, in New York, all of 20 minutes, and you say, okay, where's your parents? That they're in Canada. They're not here. I said, no, I just flew down. I'm at this little hotel, blah, blah, blah. He said, well, I want to sign you, but you're too young. You know, parents here to sign it. I said, well, call them. So we get on the phone. They call my parents, who were stunned. You know, they were saying, let them get him out of his system, go down, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right, right, right.
And they fly him down. The next day, there was Sam Clark, who was the president of the company.
And which company are we talking about? We're talking about a record company?
ABC Paramount, which was a new division of the ABC television network. It was just starting out.
Unbelievable.
So now ABC starts a label, ABC Paramount. My parents are in a room, must have been six suits all around me. You know, A&R people, the president, blah, blah, blah. They're all excited. And I'm sitting there. My dad's in shock. My mom's in shock. And we signed a contract. And they gave me $100 a month to write. And I was going to remain there until we recorded. My parents go home. I stay at the President Hotel. I had to think my uncle's down there. Somebody was watching over me. And I got up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. late. I was supposed to be there at 1, Capitol Studios, off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm freaking out. And I run from 40 South Street, about 6 blocks, to Capitol Studio. And I walk in. Now, you have to understand, I try to explain it to somebody of the newer artists that I work with, initially Michael Bublé, who I love mm-hmm. Michael, there from the beginning, still mm-hmm. am, that you're in a room and you're with top session musicians who are looking at these lead sheets and arrangements. And you're in this room, you need to study the arrangement, you rehearse for maybe, let's say, 30 minutes to get the vibe and where you're going. And you walk into a small studio, a booth, where they have a quarter inch tape, 2 reels and a quarter inch tape. And now you're put in a booth and this tape starts to roll. We're not where we are today with technology and all the stuff that we know is out there. You can cut a hit in your bedroom with your Macintosh, whatever.
Right.
And you start singing. And you're singing with sheer energy, passion, and scared to death, trying to adapt to this concept of you'll keep recording till you get what you want or what they want. And I must have done 12, 13, 14, 15 takes. And that was it. Now, if there was something you wanted to fix, and I try to tell a lot of people today, you take a razor blade, we would cut the tape, take a piece of scotch tape, put the scotch tape on the cut, and that was your fix. Then you take it from there, that you were done once you captured it. They'd put it on a piece of plastic vinyl disc. They'd walk it over to Alan Freed, send it to a couple of radio stations, and you knew in 48 hours if you had it hit. So here I am, finally get Diana Don't Gamble With Love out. Dick Clark wanted Don't Gamble With Love. Somebody turns it over to Diana. And within a week, you're booked on American Bandstand, and you're on Ed Sullivan that fall, and there's your life. There's your new life.
Unbelievable. So
you've got all of these guys around you. You got a new record company with an ABC television company that was not making money. They're just starting out. But they were shipping. A courier would take whatever money they earned off of Diana, which back then was a lot of money. They'd put it on an airplane with a courier, go out and pay the bills in Los Angeles. There and then my life changed, right? There I was.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
When I do the Ed Sullivan show, I'm in a studio where David Letterman, right on Broadway.
Right. I used to study acting on the top floor there, right above that studio.
There you go.
There you go.
They say the day before, Paul, you're going into Madison Square Gardens. We're not going to shoot it at the theater. I said, what? Small theater environment. I go to a rehearsal and I'm in this vast space, Madison Square Garden, my first big network show that I used to watch as a kid. Every Sunday, that's all you did was watch that until Mickey Mouse Club came along and television was Ed Sullivan.
Sure.
I'm on the floor and I'm rehearsing and the band was like, they could have been a city, and I have to deal with all of these elements. But I tell you, was I scared? And we go on the air, and I'm singing Diana in Madison Square Garden on my first of many Ed Sullivan shows.
Unbelievable. Tell us now about this Beatles connection. How did you meet them? How did you convince them to come conquer America? Which actually affected your career, didn't it?
Well, after Diana, I have a string of hits. I've got a kind of somewhat of a foundation of working, coming along as an entertainer, and I'm living an international life. I'm in Japan, 5 hits, big parade, and I'm sensing this international career at 17, 18, 19. I'm going to Europe. I'm constantly going to Europe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm in France, a country that I embraced at a young age, loving it. And I go to see a friend of mine who's working the classic theater, the Olympia Theater. Been there forever and still there. And I go to see my buddy who's headlining, and as it was back then, you'd have an opening act or a few opening acts, and that was pretty much the presentation all over the world. So I go in and I'm waiting for my friend to come on, and I hear, "Ladies and gentlemen, s'il vous plaît, maintenant, cette nouvelle groupe, Londres, England, c'est la Beatles. S'il vous plaît, pour la Beatles." And, you know, the crowd's, "The Beatles." I'm watching, and these guys come out with the hair and with the thing and suits and shirt and tie, but they've got, you know, it was that new vibe. And I'm looking as a musician, I'm going, "Wow." And they're doing covers. They're a cover band, opening. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, "Look at those guys. Man, that's kind of cool." So from that, I meet them. Then I go to England, and I'm, you know, thank God I took pictures. You know, nobody could believe it. And we'd become friendly in the sense of that when I was in England, I'd see them, we'd hang and we'd talk. And they would tell me, "Oh, we love this, and, you know, we love Chuck Berry, and we copied this." And I'm not really, I'm looking at myself as, you know, I'm not toting a guitar. I'm not doing what they were in terms of emulating Americans. And there was none of those, none of the English bands or artists were on the hit parade over there. It was all American artists. So we get to know each other, and they say, "We want to do what you're doing. You know, we want to publish, and we want to write." And I said, "Great, man, because I really like you guys. And you had that energy that you had." Anyway, I come back home from these trips, and I talk to my agents in New York, Normie Weiss and Sid Bernstein at General Artists. Now, you have to remember, we're in a time and a space then where it wasn't a media-driven society. It was radio. Anything you wanted to hear from Europe, yeah, it bled in a month later. You know, you knew nothing. It was all telexes, and you were short on what was happening at the time. And I'd come home, and I'd bring records home, and I'd tell Weiss and Bernstein, "These guys, these Beatles, and blah, blah, blah." And they said, "What are you talking about, Beatles?" You know, still was emerging, that whole English band thing. Finally, whatever button I pushed with them, they flew to England and met with this guy, Brian Epstein, who was their manager.
Yep.
And one thing led to another. They bring him over, and like me, only like me in terms of the only thing you could do, I'm on Sullivan earlier in my life, their first show at Sullivan. Well, the rest is history. Right. They take off. But it took me a while to convince these guys that these people are real. So then the floodgates open. And I was happy with it because prior to that, you know, we were embraced, those of us doing the pop music, et cetera, by our friends, and nobody else liked us. Parents didn't like us. Madison Avenue didn't like us. But we had our little following. When the Beatles hit, Madison Avenue opened up. Everything changed in everybody's mind in terms of pop music, because I called it pop music back then. And I thanked them for that. Well, of course, the British invasion hits, and some of us are off the radio. I'm off of my label. I buy back all my stuff for $250,000. I go to Victor, and I get into a new groove with this company because I would travel all over the world. And my record company had trouble with distributing. But when I'd walk down a street in Italy or wherever, I'd see RCA Victor, washing machine, toaster, whatever the hell they were making. I said, "Well, that's who I want to be with." So I made a deal with RCA, and that was the next phase of my life.
Wow.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's skip ahead now and get into your relationship with the Rat Pack and meeting Frank Sinatra and being friends and writing My Way. And
okay. So there we are, Bobby Darin, Frank Gale, all of us. We're growing, we're getting older. I'm mastering the songwriting thing as best I can. But we're not oblivious to the fact that we may not be around, because we had heard and we were pretty much taught that this can't last forever.
Well, what year is this now?
Late 50s.
Gotcha.
Because we all heard of this place called Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Elvis went in, didn't like it. I said, okay, I want to be like those guys. I want to learn to be an entertainer. And 58, 59, they said, look, you can't headline there, but we want you to work with Sophie Tucker. Now, I'd seen her, but I didn't know Sophie Tucker, but you know, admired the fact that she was a veteran and had some good reputation. Long and short, I'm performing with Sophie Tucker in the late 50s in Las Vegas. What they'd never seen was, there I am, this kid with Sophie Tucker, and every kid that was in school in Las Vegas, in this, you know, city that wasn't the city then, shows up. And they're going nuts in this 1,200-seat club room, and poor Sophie Tucker's getting pissed, but in a very gracious manner. Where is she? My boy, I want you to close the show. So they made me close the show. She'd go on first to keep the kids in the room, keep them quiet. And that was my first taste of Vegas. Now, I had been there. I was like Darren and Avalon. We loved these guys, Frank Sinatra. We loved swing. We couldn't do it. So what we did is we put acts together with big band and say, that's our goal. We got to work the clubs. So I started late 60s at the Copacabana in New York City. That was your kind of your entree to Vegas. Now, you're in an environment where the mob, whatever you want to call them, the boys, they ran everything. Right. Whether it was the record business, music, cement business, the nightclubs, and they were great to work for. Gentlemen, right? In an industry that was in its infancy stage. So from Sophie Tucker, from the Copa, where everything went well for me, I wind up with these guys that I idolized and intimidated to be around, called the Rat Pack, and I'm working in the Sands Hotel. Now here we are, I got this kid still, maybe early 20s, sitting in steam rooms, nude, looking at these guys nude, having trouble with eye contact, not believing I'm in a room with these guys. And it went from there, you know, getting to know them, adoring Sammy Davis, who became my friend, adoring Sinatra, who was very gracious with me, teaching me. They're befuddled in a sense on what's this kid doing in our world? You know, kids selling lots of records, making money for the guys. And they slot me in, and I'm stepping up. You know, I'm a hit. My act is good and blah, blah, blah. And I'm learning my trade. I'm learning how to be a performer. So all the 60s, I'm with these guys. But I'm younger, and I don't know how to approach them and go, you know, I got a song for you, because I'm still, you know, coming off a longest day. I got Tonight Show theme. So the cred is getting broader. Till one day at the Fountain Blue Hotel. Great hotel. You'd work Vegas, and then you'd wind up at the Fountain Blue. Nothing like it. Had style. It had class.
And that's Miami you're talking about.
Miami, Florida.
Yeah.
So between Vegas and Miami, Florida, that was your hang spot with these guys. And here I am growing up with the Rat Pack, if you will.
Oh, boy.
To one day when Sinatra was doing a film in Miami, I'm working the Laurent Room at the Fountain Blue. Mid-60s, he's doing a film called Lady in Ice, I think, Lady in Ice, which with the guys that we worked for, it could have been a documentary, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were still working for the boys. I'm having dinner one night. I think he was married to Mia Farrow,
right,
who was 21, and he was, you know, pick a high number.
Right.
So he's going through that dilemma. He's going through wanting to retire. The Rat Pack is older. And he's being very open with me as to, I think I've had enough, I think I'm going to get up, blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying to myself, he's going to quit. He's going to do one more album with Don Costa, my guy, who I introduced to Sinatra. And I never wrote a song for him. One thing leads to another within that creative process. And this was a spiritual moment for me. After hearing that at the Fountain Blue, where we had such great times together, once I get back to New York, 12 midnight, sitting there in front of my typewriter, I still type from my days of school, 70 words a minute. I start metaphorically, and now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. All about him, as if he were writing it. Finish it at 5 in the morning. I call him in Vegas. I think he was at Caesars. One thing leads to another. The next night, because he had said, get out here with it, blah, blah, blah. I'm in his dressing room. I play him my way. A couple of months later, I get a phone call. He's in Los Angeles at a record studio. Kid, that was my nickname. We all had nicknames. Sammy was Smokey the Bear. Dean was Vino. Everyone that hung around with them on your bathrobe in the health clubs, you had your name under that. He says, kid, listen to this. And he took the phone, he put it next to a speaker. And I heard My Way for the first time. Well, the guy that was retiring and quitting now stayed 10 more years, changed my life as a writer, my gravitas, and changed it for him. And you know the rest of the story.
He recorded your song without you knowing it.
Oh, I knew he was doing it. I was in the dressing room, played it for him. Costa's involved. 2 months later, he calls me from the studio with Costa. They had just recorded it. No one else had heard it yet. And they played it to me over the phone.
That famous recording that everybody knows. You heard that over the phone.
Over the phone, L.A. to New York.
Wow.
Yeah. And I cried. I had happy tears.
I'll bet you did. How did My Way change your life? Did it change your life immediately? What happened?
Well, it changed my life in the moment because I knew I had something. You know, I had enough under my feet as a song guy to know this was something pretty special. It changed his life that he decided to stay in the business. Even though he went into retirement, and then I wrote Let Me Try Again, which was his comeback song. But it changed his, you know, I humbly submit. It changed mine certainly because, you know, everything prior to that was love songs and, you know, stuff that was in the growth pattern of working at my craft. It was that unusual and different a song that it changed both our lives, absolutely.
Mm. You must have been flooded with offers for the top artists in the world to co-write with you or for you to write material for them. I'm sure that happened. How did you handle that?
Well, yes. All of a sudden, it changed in that everybody wanted to write with you, but they wanted to write another My Way. Well, it doesn't work like that. You're not going to have 15 My Way songs. But it certainly opened up the respect and the gravitas, because prior to that, I was in the niche of writing for my age. And the song was so different in the environment of what was making it then. You know, Hendrix had opened it up. There was rock. There was the folk stuff that was happening. But here was this different type of material for the guy that was the guy. Right. You know, nobody else could be Sinatra. He was the guy. So, yeah, I started writing with people. That kind of came a little later. But what it did was it gets me the record deal to happen with Jubilation, Streisand with Jubilation, Do I Love You with Donna Fargo, number one country record, Having My Baby, One Man Woman, I Don't Like to Sleep Alone, number one records again. So it opened the door and the attention to, well, wait a second, My Way and now the 70s with this stuff. So with writing with others and with the acceptance, if you will, in a very fickle business, where really you learn at an early age, nobody really cares. You know, they'll eat you up and spit you out. That's how it changed my life. It gave me a new credential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I'd let me try again with him. And I was writing She's a Lady and all that stuff started to happen.
I'm a huge Tom Jones fan. I grew up watching his weekly show, and he'd come out and go crazy with his dance routines and his great vocals, and the girls would go crazy.
Yeah, I was there.
And it's not unusual to be loved by anyone, and he would start out the show with that. Tell us about working with Tom Jones.
So I was with the same agency as Tom Jones, and he and Engelbert Humperdinck were probably a third of the gross earnings of this agency.
Right.
And I'm working in Vegas. And of course, they were familiar with My Way. They're familiar with my career. And like, he wanted to meet Presley. Presley wanted to meet him. I wanted to meet Tom. Tom and me. So we all got to know each other. We got to know each other well, to where they come to my home. We'd sit up and watch movies, because I'd get these movie reels from the movie companies. We'd sit till 9, 10 in the morning drinking champagne, having a good time. So we lock in. We're playing tennis together. I'm in England. I'm on Tom's show. And it gets to, well, what about me? Write me a song. That's the lady. I finished a show in England, and I spent a lot of time with him. And I think I started it on the back of a dinner menu on TWA, because that was the carrier we go back and forth on. So we get She's a Lady out there. I try to capture the vibe of this sex idol, and et cetera. He never had a number one record in the United States. Never. She's a Lady was his one and only.
Mm-hmm.
So we write that, and of course we lock, you know, we lock in, we hang, and we're all together. We're friends for many, many years. They record a few of my songs, you know, from Papa, We Made It Happen. And I had a great relationship with them and their manager for quite a few years. And Tom's a great singer.
No, he's a fantastic voice. Yeah.
And here we are today. He's still doing what he's doing, and I'm doing what I'm doing, and Engelbert's doing what he's doing.
Man. Wow. I'm just overwhelmed. Let me ask you this. Do you prefer being the songwriter or the performer, or is it a mix of both for you?
From a security standpoint, I like being the writer, because it's a fallback position, and I think that the kind of gravitas that comes with it, you know, back to the Beatles, we want to write, we want to. That's a stable kind of consciousness that you live in. The performing thing was morphing and morphing. You know, you're constantly learning, and you're constantly getting comfort zones, but you're in front of people. You're writing, you're by yourself in there on your own time schedule, if you will, and you can just sit there and take your time and kind of wait for it to happen. But the performing is fun.
Right.
So 20 years I've enjoyed, you know, feeling that I knew what I was doing. connecting with an audience, with a body of work? So the answer to the question is both. I would venture to guess that if I didn't have the gift of writing, I don't think we'd be talking today, frankly. Mm. I think anybody was interested, nor were they, to write for a 15-year-old kid in an industry that was growing. No one would have the state of mind to say, okay, here's what you're going to say. I'm so young and you're so old. Or you're going to go, and they called it popular, or put your head on my, I'm just a look. Those all came from my feelings as a teenager, right? Mm-hmm. So the writing world for me was the most important to keep up.
Right.
You know, I didn't really start feeling confident until Longest Day, Tonight Show theme, where people started looking at me different, you know, kids growing, you know. So the performing thing was a roll of the dice. It was working, but I didn't feel as secure doing that as I did as a writer.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because, God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me ask you this, from songwriter to songwriter, and I've never sold anything to anybody, but do you have any control after you give the song to an artist about the final product? When you hear it, are you surprised? Are you positive about what you hear? Or are you like, oh, you know, maybe we should edit it and this, you know, give them some direction, or you just give the song away?
Good question, actually. you don't always have control once you submit a demonstration, a demo, we call it.
Right.
Of how you feel the song, depending on the artist. Sinatra, I gave him a piano demo. She's a Lady had some rhythm elements to it. Once you give it to certain established artists, whether it was Streisand with Jubilation, Lady with Tom, the Sinatra stuff, you're really trusting and putting it in the hands of professionals.
Right.
You're putting it in the hands of people that know how to do good. You're putting it in the hands of those that have realized there's something great. They've been gifted as an artist. Mm-hmm. And that seems to always work for them. So the answer is there is a wall that once it leaves you, you have to trust what their perception is and their talent group that sits down and vibes what fits their artist. Now, I've always approached it as a casting person in a motion picture. Mm. You know what you're writing for Tom. You know his capability, his
range. Right.
You know the way Sinatra sings, so I'm emulating when you're writing.
Right.
So you're typecasting, you're trusting when you give it away, and you sit and wait for the phone call. Now, when I heard Sid Vicious singing My Way, Marty Scorsese called and said, I'm using it in my film, I was taken aback. And I didn't know whether I wanted to relinquish the rights for the usage till I woke up a few days later and said, "What? Who am I to sit here and judge what someone across the waters was feeling on this song that meant something to him?" And realizing he went to Paris and redid an amplifier and had a jazz, and he did it the way he felt it, I didn't judge it. I said, you know what? I dig the honesty in that, mm-hmm. and I'm going to grant that. Now, there's no way I could have perceived what he was going to do with it. And ultimately, I accepted it. So you're really sitting there hoping that as part of this team, that you're going to hear what comes back to you. Mm-hmm. In most cases, I like what came back to me. I never, you know, when Donny Osmond was, they wanted to do Puppy Love, they wanted to do Lonely Boy. And he did a couple of my tunes. I accepted it, you know. I heard it the way that they perceived it. And I can't really tell you that there's ever a large percentage of treatments that I didn't like. You know, I can't really say. And you don't have a say, as I said earlier,
right,
to go elbowing around everybody say, do it this. Now, when I wound up with Buddy Holly, I had no idea what Jacobs, the arranger, his producer, was a song that started on a guitar. You know, he taught me chords, and it was simply, you know, very young. There you go, baby. Here am I. And I'm emulating him, and hear the guitar strumming. Now, we get to New York, and there's this huge string section and a big orchestra. I'm going, whoa, what we got here? But he wanted to do what I was doing. He wanted big band. He wanted strings, something he'd never done. He was on his solo career now.
Mm-hmm.
Left a bad situation, and this was going to be his new sound. So that threw me at first, but I got it. You know, I got the genius of Jacobs and where they were going with that. But that was a differential from the kind of demo that I made.
Do you know you're writing a hit when you're writing a hit? Do you know it's a hit? Does it come to you quickly? Does it download from the muse instantly and it's a rush to get it down? Is that how it works for you?
We'd all be richer in this business if we knew that. You don't really know, other than being a professional, you don't really know other than when you know you've got something special, but the journey ahead is how do you capture it?
Right.
I had a feeling on My Way. I had a feeling on She's a Lady, but you don't really know.
Right.
You know when you got something you like, you know something that's has the merit, you know something that could be, but till the process is finished, you don't know.
Right.
You know, I've sat with so many writers, and I've been blessed with all kinds of great writers. And you sit there, and you know you got something. You know, whether it's Burt Bacharach, Michael McDonald, I mean, all the guys I live with, but you don't know that you get there. They don't know till it's finished. No.
Interesting. I'm actually going to Nashville middle of next month to co-write with some Warner Chappell artists. They want me to come down and co-write with them. I've never co-written. Can you give me any advice on how that process is? Because I've never tried to do it. And now I'm getting in the arena with people that are actually known and gifted and all that. So
if the vibe and everything in life is that chemical attachment with someone, or you're looking for a relationship, you're looking for a business venture, you should know within an hour, hour and a half, maybe sooner, your feeling for this person. You should know whether there's a compatibility. You should know what you share in terms of music, where you're all coming from. Then it could be a great process, because now you have this bouncing off of each other and mutual respect for each other, that you know, what instrument do you play? Are you a piano player, guitar player?
I write on guitar.
So you're going to the right place, Nashville. Mm-hmm. There's a guitar every 3 yards. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to sit with guys that have guitars and piano. And you're going to know within that first couple of hours, you got to be relaxed and you got to be open-minded to sit there and go, okay, what do we want to write about? Where's the hook? What's the key line here? Where are we going with that? You need to now morph with someone that you respect and you have a feeling for to get that initial idea to where you ultimately want to go. Now, that may take you a day. You may get it in 6 hours. You may get it in 3 days once you've locked into it. But it can be an incredible experience working with someone that brings to the table what you bring to the table, taking the heavy load off of you and having this broad spectrum of creative foundation to work from. So it can be very cool. But that first couple of hours, communicating, getting to know each other is very important. Now, you could find also that you're going to go nowhere. You know, it was a different thing for me writing with Michael Jackson, because he didn't have an instrument. You know, I had to sit and lay chords and do. But I heard the talent with his sounds. Everything was a sound with him, right?
Right, right.
But I knew within the first couple of hours, once we found our kind of place with each other, that something was going to come out of it. And I had his last three hits. You know, This Is It, Love Never Felt So Good, and the Drake record, It Don't Matter to Me. That was
unbelievable.
The most experience I've ever had to write with someone was with Michael Jackson.
Unbelievable. My wife is going to die when she hears this. She's a huge Michael Jackson fan, and she loves those songs. She knew I was talking to you today. She wanted to like sit in and ask you questions, but I said, you know.
Was an interesting artist. You know, I knew him as a kid with his family. They came to my show in Vegas. They grew up with that whole era of Sinatra and myself. So when I finally got in a room with them together in my home in Carmel, it was like heartwarming, and then see him grow up and see where he was coming from, where he was intellectually dealing with the business. So that was a pretty cool journey for me, writing those songs with him.
I'll bet. Let's talk a little bit about your podcast. How'd that come about? What's it about?
Well, I've had, for the last few years, do a podcast, you got great stories, blah, blah, blah. I let my son-in-law carry it, Jason Bateman, who's very successful in that world.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't have time. I was traveling. I didn't have interest, frankly. I told my stories and went on Stern, and I've done all of them, and I'd like to leave it at that. One thing leads to another, and someone, I think, heard me on Bateman, and it led to iHeartRadio and my buddy Skip Bronson, who's a friend. We talk every day. Someone came up with the notion after hearing me on a few of these that, you should do a podcast. And after seeing Skip and I hang out at lunches and what have you, why don't you guys do it together? And I looked at it, I'm not going to make $1 zillion. I'm going to have a lot of fun. And with my buddy, I can take an hour or two out of the day. If I can inspire someone with it, if I can in any way give them some kind of a look into life of writing or whatever, let's do it. So So it was that quick, you know, it was just a bunch of people coming together, putting it together and letting Skip saying, yeah, I'm going to do it because, you know, I don't think that's anything he was thinking of doing.
Mm-hmm.
Came together quickly in an environment where everybody got a podcast. So now we're all in the same boat, right? Mm-hmm. So we knew what we were going to draw from our friends and everything. And I had some time to do it. You know, I don't want to work 200 days a year like I used to. I tour 50 to 75 days. I've got my other stuff. And I can fit this in because I can do it from my house where I am. And that was it. And we have great friends. Now we've got Bill Burr was on the other night. He was a buddy. And that was just hilarious. Jason did it. We've got a whole list of great people who know how to talk about their life and their experience. And we're having fun with it.
You're gonna have the president of France on.
The guy I'm talking to, that was a PR guy, because I was given an award by the president, just quit. So now I've got to deal with a new guy. You know, politics has never changed. That's a whole other world that I don't want to be a part of, which we all have to respect in the fact of how it helps us deal with our lives or not. But yeah, we'll ultimately get him. We've got Carlos Slim coming on from Mexico.
Oh, wow.
We've got a lot of interesting people. We've got Kimmel. We got commitments from people. Yeah.
Right. Well, good. I wish you the best of luck with all of that. And it is the easiest job and the best job I've had in my life is doing a podcast. It's really quite fun. And iHeart's great, and they're great support.
Yeah.
I wish you the best with that.
What made it easy was the unknown that hits you, and then the reality of what you're dealing with, and the whole team that I've worked with. They're just amazing to work with, and it makes life easier, you know, to get on base right away and not watch a revolving door to get to where you want to.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and ask you if I could send you a song.
Sure.
That I wrote that I think you would like.
Well, I'm sure I would like it. The challenge today for guys like me and everyone in the business is what do you do with them? You know, everybody's writing their own stuff.
If you like this song, we'll figure out what to do with it. But if you like it, if it does something for you, the thought of you listening to one of my songs.
Who did it? The butler did it. Now you're back. If I like the song, boom. Song, you go from there. You know, what you deal is with clarity, transparency, honesty.
Right.
And go, I can do it. I don't know who can do it. I don't know if I'm doing an album. Maybe it should go here. You know, because the music business has changed so drastically. I mean, I feel.
It really has.
For people out there, it's not like years ago. You know where you're going. You get a place. You're probably going to the right place in Nashville because they still have a channel to artists that don't write, where most of them do, where there's possibility of getting a artist to do a song. Today, I don't even see a lot of artists wanting to do CDs or to contribute anymore because it's changed. You got these artists that years ago, you had a promotion team. You're making a great album. Everyone's excited. You do an album today, there's no promotion team. They're not spending. So I could list you a bunch of people that put albums up. They don't do 40,000 CDs. Not good.
No.
So with the streaming and everything going on, it's where do you go with a song? Who do you give it to? You know, at the end of the day, who I'm going to give the songs to.
Right. I think you give them away. I think with the world of social media, it's like you can't really sell them. You know, the money's in the touring. I mean, if you want to earn a living, it's touring and merch, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, I've got a song brewing now with Tiger.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he's got it in his studio. I think he likes it. We'll see. But you keep trying. You keep doing. But like you say, all artists make their money on the road.
Right.
They're not making the music.
Right.
You've got artificial intelligence that's going to change our lives so drastically. It's not going to be here. But wait, the creative process, next 3 years, it will change lives in all occupational forms. And it's going to change in the music business, film, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think AI is going to, I think we're looking at massive copyright and infringement issues and lawsuits coming down the pike. They'll
try to prevent that.
Right.
Theoretically, okay, but it's too big and there's too many power bases that'll sit down with the right people and say, okay, guys, look, you can't do this. These are intellectual rights. You can't do that. There's a lot of money to be made. Let's do the right thing. They don't want 2,000 figuratively lawsuits coming at them. You know, they won't. You have to accept change. And you have to be optimistic. I've lived through change all my life. You hang in. You keep on keeping on. You take the blows. I hope it changes for the best. And it will. I'm worried about the guys that are going to be out of work in other occupations. Forget about senators. You're going to have people that will not have jobs, and the governments and the corporations will have to restructure, tell everybody to stay home, work 2 days a week. I'm just giving you, we'll give you money. They'll go out and they'll spend it. And you'll see this globe now with where we have to contend with China and Europe and Russia. And there'll be this huge change wrapped around artificial intelligence. Let's hope we use it right, and let's hope everybody survives with it. But it's coming. You'll see it in medicine. You've got all kinds of new applications with AI or technology that's unheard of, and it's coming, and it will happen, and it's a wonderful thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is why live entertainment will grow in popularity, because they won't be able to get it anywhere else. Nothing will be real in their lives except live theater and live music and live this and live that. So.
Correct.
I'm hopeful for that.
Mother's Day is coming, and mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent, telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step, and you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because, God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Would you do us the honor of playing rapid fire with us? The thought of playing rapid fire with you, it's something we do with all of our guests, and it's just sort of basic Gilmore questions, and I ask you what your preferences are, and it's, you can answer if you want to. Would you do that for us?
I would love to do it. Yeah, just depends on the questions, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, here's the first question. How do you like your coffee?
I like my coffee. I am not a sugar guy. I use honey agave. I use oat milk and black, of course. I like the French press where I put it in. I do the purest form of coffee. I do coffee a minimum of 4 times a day, maybe more, because I think, and I'm an avid reader on all fronts, that coffee is healthy for you.
Mm.
So I drink it. Right. I'm afraid to. I've spoken to doctors about it because I'm a health freak. And that's how I like it. I don't generally do shots, but I do cups of black coffee if done properly out of the right mechanism.
Great. Next question. Are you Team Logan, Team Jess, or Team Dean? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I can't intelligently answer that question.
Good. Would you rather work with Michelle or Kirk?
Michelle.
Why?
I like Michelle.
Because he's Canadian. He's from Montreal.
I feel a chemistry with Michelle.
What would you order at Luke's Diner?
I would order a hamburger and a milkshake.
Who would you rather hang out with, Paris or Lane?
Paris.
Why?
I like Paris.
Harvard or Yale?
With the state of those universities today, look, colleges are going through some real transitions. The whole education system to me is a little frail. I don't like a few things going on, but they're both great. They're both great.
Okay.
I think going into the legal field, obviously Harvard.
Would you rather attend a DAR event with Emily or a town meeting with Taylor?
I think a town meeting with Taylor.
Gilmore Girls character that you would want as a roommate.
Wow. You know, listen, roommate, girlfriend, wives, one room. That's a serious question.
It's serious, man. Who do you think?
Wow. Give me 3 choices.
Okay.
Female.
Right. No, I knew that. Let me see. Well, you like Paris, so let's say Paris or Babette or Lorelai. Paris, Babette, or Lorelai. Sally Struthers played Babette.
Paris.
Paris again. Paris for the win. Like,
the city of Paris has been good to me, and I'm going with Paris.
Okay. Something in your life you are all in on.
I'm all in on empathy for others, being non-judgmental, and I'm all in on trying to constantly institute the necessity of love for one another with people. I think there's some kind of a cure based around if everybody can feel more love than they are, and mm-hmm. empathy and kindness. And that's traveling throughout the world where I see all of the adversity, the treatment of people. It's never going to always be perfect, but I think if people could start learning a little more about kind, empathetic, and show some love, it's going to be a little easier on everybody. because I've never seen the world in this state that it's in right now. I think that there's some pain ahead of us here until certain things are resolved. And the only thing ultimately that's going to inch you ahead is feeling empathy, kindness, and love for people. Other than that, it's going to get worse, you know, because there's just too many unresolved things that are going on, you know, for my liking, that are not making it an easy world to live in.
I have one last question.
Yeah.
And I thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this. Are you aware, based on just one song that you wrote, My Way, of the impact, the positive impact that that has had on literally billions of people since you have written that song, and it will continue to positively impact people in a very positive way so that they can show that empathy and love and get strength from that song? Are you aware of the impact of that song?
I learned very early in my creative life, my life as a, with what I do, you sit in a room and you create, even when you perform. But you take My Way, as you mentioned, there's a large black hole between me sitting here today with you and what people are embracing out there with My Way or whatever song, but let's use My Way. You don't fully realize ever with that black hole in front of you how you've affected people. Where you get a sense of it when you're performing up there, and you hit that song in your lineup and you see the tears, you see the reaction of people, you see how they react to you at the end of it. Only then do you get a sense. You get a sense on when someone comes up to you. You get a sense when you get a letter from someone that's dealing with someone that does not have the health, someone that's their brother is on death row in a prison. You eclectically get these responses. But to say that I fully get it, no, absolutely not. I don't think any of us do. You know, I was at a dinner party the other night with a top neurosurgeon in the country. I didn't know him. He didn't know me. And it came out within the dinner, you know, how My Way was his song. He said, but I'm going to tell you something. I wouldn't tell a lot of people. When I was operating in the 70s, and I would go in and take a tumor the size of an orange, whatever, out of someone's head, as I would pull it out, I would sing Having My Baby. I said, you know, I've never heard much about my song Having My Baby other than the obvious meaning. But you're telling me it's like pulling a baby. He said, absolutely. And everyone there was in accord. He said, don't do it anymore because they're now younger. They don't know the song. But I would be singing Having My Baby. And, you know, it's kind of back to what you said. That was such an impact on me the other night. I'm saying, I can't get my head around that. You'd be pulling a cancerous and if someone's head and you're singing Having My Baby, he says, where did that? So you never know. You just never know the full impact. Now, you take a country like the Philippines, where they take their music seriously. I know for a fact, because they're just an amazing country in terms of how they embrace music and singing. I think three people are dead because of a karaoke bar. They sang My Way the wrong way, and they shot them.
Oh.
Now, if you look it up, you read the content in the event. They shoot people for singing My Way the wrong way. Look at the extreme of that. And it's been written up. It's you. When we're done, you'll Google it and you'll see.
I will.
Who got shot in the Philippines in a karaoke bar? That's not the effect that I want my song to have on anyone.
It has been a pleasure. It really has. I feel like I can quit podcasting now because I've done the interview, and but I won't.
You'll keep doing it because you do it well, and you're going to go to Nashville, and you're going to do that well, and you're going to constantly feel what music and the magic that it has, and obviously conversations, what it does for you. Because if you have a passion for something in life, well, you're so ahead of the game. Because most people, no, some people don't have a passion and a commitment to what they're doing. And that's always sad to me, because you have to have that in your life to have a fulfilled life. You know, you just need that passion. So you're fortunate and I'm fortunate.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for sharing your stories. Thank you for your time. It has been an honor.
And just get Paris in the room with me somewhere, would you?
I will. I'll see what I can do.
Have a good day.
I'll send you that song. Have a great rest of your day. Good luck with the podcast. Thank you again.
Well, I've got a Broadway show that I'm dealing with here today. You know, we got the money, and now I have to sit and go through the writing process, which they want done in 6 months. So that's a new one, and that's a huge hurdle. That's a one-time shot. It has to be done. Can't make a mistake there. So that's where I'm going from you.
Broadway show. Just scoring a Broadway show. Okay.
No, they're the story of my life.
Oh, is that right? It's going to be about you.
Yeah, starting at 15, and we're down to the list of songs, and I'm dealing with writers now.
Have you seen the Springsteen Broadway show?
Yeah. I saw it on Netflix, I think, or something.
Yeah, I'm watching
that. So this is going to be a full-out show cast.
Full deal. Okay.
We've got to get two actors, maybe three. One who can handle it at 15, 16, and mid-20s, and then depends. We'll probably end it my way.
What a great idea. What a great idea.
We'll see how this idea marches.
But I mean, just to stage all those big songs, what a great idea. Oh, yeah. Man. I wish you luck with that one.
I've lived on luck. I'll always take luck.
All right. Thank you again.
Thanks,
ladies and gentlemen, Paul Anka. We're talking about one of the giants of the past 60, 65, even 70 years in the entertainment field. An honor to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Forget, follow us on Instagram at I Am All In Podcast and email us at Gilmore@iHeartRadio.com.
Ah, summer. The best time of the year usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there was another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. At IKEA, everyone can have lounge chair access. No reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, they have all of the essentials that you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
Who doesn't love shopping at Target? Did you know the all-new Target Circle is the free and easy way to get the most deals at Target? And when you pay with your Target Circle card, you can save an extra 5% your way every day. But wait, there's more. Now you've got a new way to save with Target Circle 360. With unlimited same-day delivery, Target Circle 360 is the fastest way to get your order to your door or someone else's. Right now, sign up for Target Circle 360 for just $49 for your first year of membership. That's $50 off the regular price. Visit target.com/circle or the Target app for more details. Same day delivery is subject to terms, applies to orders over $35. For 5% discount, restrictions apply. See program rules in store or at target.com/circle card.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy
taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.